Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're offering a preview of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. It officially opens its doors on Saturday. My guests are Mary Elliott. She is the co-curator of the Slavery and Freedom Exhibit, at the museum, and Janae Smith, CEO of the Jock Michael Smith Collection. Lines are open if you have a question or a comment about the museum, and I'm sure you do, so please, I'll take as many phone calls as possible at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Omar, calling from Silver Spring. Thanks for calling, Omar. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you, ladies, for all the hard work in making this possible.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, I have three questions, and I really like to get a full answer.
Okay, we'll do what we can. We've got a lot of calls on the line, so ask your most important question first if you can.
I wanted to know if you had to give credit to anybody, who would it be to make this possible in addition to you ladies? And also, was it this federal funding or was it private funding or a combination of both? And regarding Bill Cosby, is he going to be part of the exhibition?
So in terms of the funding, we have half the funding came from the federal government, and then we had to raise half the funding through private funds. And I am proud to say that we raised more than half. We are actually exceeded our goals. So it's thanks to the public for really understanding the importance of this project. And we want you your continued help, but we cannot thank everyone enough for everything that they've done to help us get this off the ground. In terms of Bill Cosby, the story will be featured in the exhibition in the story on Taking the Stage. We look at Bill Cosby's legacy in the entertainment industry, and we speak about what is going on now to the extent that how it has impacted that legacy. So it is addressed in the exhibition. In terms of who the people are that we would credit for really getting us going and helping to make sure that this came to fruition, we cannot help but stop to reflect on these African-American men who fought in the Civil War and in 1916 pushed for a museum to be built, a national museum to honor African-Americans who fought in the military. That was 100 years ago. And so in the 1920s, it picked up steam. There was an issue with having to raise enough funds. And then we were fortunate enough that Congress and President Bush, George W. Bush, signed the legislation to make this a reality. So those are the foundational folks. But I would be remiss if I did not say that the scholar John Hope Franklin is foundational to all of the intellectual underpinnings of this museum, and I would be absolutely remiss if I did not say under the leadership of Lonnie Bunch, this would not have happened. He has carried the world on his shoulders, and he's a strong enough man to do it. But I tell you what, I pat him on the back at every chance I get because he's been a powerful leader.
Well, Omar, thank you so much for your question. Excellent questions, because this is not... You know, this is not a cheap undertaking. $540 million and more than $500 million and counting, because this museum with all of its exhibits is not a stagnant process, because I'm sure just like many of the other museums, things are going to be moving in and out.
Mm-hmm. We have our permanent exhibits, which are the inaugural exhibitions you see up. There'll be a space for a rotating exhibition. We have our objects, for the most part, they're all supposed to be on view for 10 years, but there will be things that will rotate out. I have to say this, you know, this has been a Herculean effort, but this has been an effort that African Americans have come out in numbers.
Absolutely.
To give to this museum. And in that same vein, I have to say that white people, Latino people, American Indian, everyone has been waiting for this moment, and people have given objects and money. This has been a collective effort to bring forward this shared history. So we're really excited about that.
Janae, talk to me briefly about how you were able to get connected with the museum, because in the Jock Michael Smith collection, as you said, you're talking about, you know, 10,000 individual pieces, big and small. How did you get connected with the museum?
Yes. What happened was there was a point maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, my father was still alive, when I thought, Dad, we're sinning by keeping this in our private vault. The items that we have were world changers, game changers, as the sports gallery is named so aptly in this museum. And so I started talking to him about how can we exhibit and who would be a great partner. And to be quite honest, we only had three that I was floating around at the time. It was the Smithsonian, ESPN, or Disney. Now, I was just sitting around the kitchen at my parents one random Thanksgiving. But the point was, I said, I'm going to go and find out who are the people who know how to exhibit. Ultimately, Google led me to AAM, the American Association of Museums. I didn't know anybody, but as we know, as HBCU grads, all you got to have is a wish and a hope. And so I registered for that conference. I showed up with the gift of gab and the good Lord on my shoulders and literally just talked to everybody I could to say, I have this amazing sports collection. It's nothing like it in the world. And I don't know where I want to put it, but I'll know it when you tell me if it's good. It needs to be magnificent.
It was committed. Well done.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was committed to there being that the story was being told, not just highlighting the athletic accomplishment and statistics. I needed the cultural story told. Ultimately, it was at that conference that I met Kinshasa Holman-Conwell, who I didn't know anything about her, also another Howard grad, I like to say. I didn't know anything about her and her stature in the world of the museum industry. But I met her. I told her what I had. She said, young lady, if you're telling the truth, you just made my life. And if you're lying, I'm going to kill you.
But, Harold, you have to know, Kinshasa used to be the director of the Studio Museum in Harlem, New York.
Okay.
And she is amazing.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
And so I met her, and that started the conversation.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Reverend Pendleton calling from Baltimore. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
So, I have just a comment, and thank you, Harold, for having me on your radio show. Just to get the comment.
Sure.
I don't really believe, I pastor millennials in Baltimore, and I really don't believe they understand the magnitude of what this means. To have our culture have its own museum in the Smithsonian is major. In our community, we only have little pockets of information that give our history. Here in Baltimore, we have the great Blacks and Whites Museum. But we had to have such a monument to our culture, a monument to our people in Washington, D.C., a part of the Smithsonian, is mind-blowing. It's history-making. So I wanted to just tell the two young ladies who you have with you in the studio and on the phone, thank you for a job well done. My family, my church, my youth are excited about coming to D.C. to see what you all have exhibited, that you all have posted for that. So that's what I just wanted to tell y'all. Thank you. And I hope our millennials, our young people can really understand how big this is.
Well, Reverend, thank you so much for your comments. I appreciate it. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Caroline calling from D.C. What's on your mind, Caroline? Caroline, are you there?
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, I also want to thank you for the job well done. I wanted to know how we get tickets. I know that the opening, they sold them out real quick. But how can we get tickets? I live in D.C., but I have family from all over, and one of my sisters is a retired history teacher. I know she wants to come. How is the best way to get tickets, and will they be available after the opening a lot more freely?
So we had tickets, and this just shows you the magnitude of what the good Reverend just said. We actually issued 28,500 tickets in an hour. And the next ticket availability, I believe, is for November. The best thing to do is to go online to our website, which is www.nmaahc.si.edu. That's N as in national, M as in museum, AA, African American, H, history, C, culture, at smithsonianinstitution.edu. You'll see a section there to reserve tickets. Now, we have it where you have to reserve time tickets because the volume of people coming is just historic in itself. But there's also an opportunity to come during the day because they will issue a limited number of tickets that you can get during the day. I highly recommend you do that early. There will be an opportunity if you didn't get them online and you want to come before November, you can come during the day. Again, it's a limited number they're going to issue each day, but you can come and request tickets during the day.
Okay. Are there any available still for Saturday?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll be out on the mall, but I did want to know because of my family.
Please come on the mall because we're having a 3-day festival, and the headliners include The Roots. It includes Public Enemy, Living Color, Michelle Ndege Achello, and you cannot do DC without having Go-Go. So it also includes Experience Unlimited.
There you go. Caroline, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Karima, calling from Virginia. What's on your mind? Karima, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead, please.
Thank you. I wanted to know we have tickets to come in October, and I wanted to maximize the time that I have when we're there. I know we're not going to be able to get to see everything, so I wanted your recommendation in terms of where we should actually start in the museum.
Well, I'm actually laughing. Look, I'm laughing to myself because I got to tell you, we had our donor preview on Saturday, and people come in and when I tell you the depth of information we have, it's you can go through and read the labels, but people are so moved they want to read every label. I have people who said they're going to come back again and again and take one floor at a time. But it really does depend on what your personal interest is. If you want to start in culture or community or history, the History Gallery, it includes an exhibition on slavery and freedom, defending and defining freedom, which is segregation period, and then also A Changing America, which is 1968 to today. And then, of course, we have the community exhibitions, which include features the sports exhibit. It features the military exhibit. We have an amazing exhibit on the power of place and on making a way out of no way. And then culture speaks for itself on the fourth floor, taking the stage, musical crossroads, visual arts, and cultural resources. But it's a powerful museum. And all I can tell you is pick what you like and go there first and then come back again and again and again.
And wear very comfortable shoes. Wear very comfortable shoes.
And after you've seen everything, you'll have a PhD.
And bring some Kleenex.
Yeah, there is that much information. Karima, thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Alisa, calling from Maryland. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Go right ahead. Alisa, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I want to first thank you and your guests for their contributions to preserving African-American history in this country. I think it's amazing. I wanted to know if anyone had seen, I've seen the America I Am exhibit, and if there's any way to compare or contrast that exhibition to what's going on in this museum.
I have not seen it. I have only heard about it. But I would, argue that this is an original and that there is nothing else to compare it, not only to museums of African-American history and culture, but, just compared to some of the other, museums that are on the mall, because the museums on the mall, first of all, we are talking about the Smithsonian, and it is a storied organization. And just like anything else, and I'm speaking as a native Washingtonian, you can't just go and have one bite at this apple. It's going to take time, just like the Museum of Natural History or the Air and Space Museum,
yes,
or any of the other museums there. I mean, this is truly a gem, a crown, mm-hmm, so could say.
Well, I would say I know that exhibition was a traveling exhibition, and it was featured here in D.C. at the National Geographic space. And One thing I would say is this museum is unique, but we also are working with local African-American museums around the country. So we want you to come here and see how special this museum is, but understand that this history is told throughout the nation by other stewards who are really helping to maintain and tell these stories.
Absolutely.
Alisa, thank you so much for your comment. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about sports and ask both of my guests some of their favorite pieces of the exhibits and what they actually mean to them. We'll be back in just a moment. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are offering a preview of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. Of course, it opens officially on Saturday. I want to talk to Janae, just a little bit about some of the pieces that you've, you know, loaned to the museum. What is the piece that you think is most significant and why?
For me.
Uh-huh, for you personally.
I'll say what's most significant. Then if you'd like, I might suggest what I have found from the public to maybe be the most excited about. For me, what's most significant is a pair of Jesse Owens track cleats from the 1936 Olympics, which those happened in Berlin, Germany. Mm-hmm. So he got those four gold medals right in front of Adolf Hitler. Before the Holocaust had really taken effect, but he was on the verge of creating that horror. So for an African-American man who even in his homeland wasn't treated fairly to go and perform at such a high caliber on that stage during those times, that's personally what I feel to be the most powerful artifact of the Jock Michael Smith collection at all. And it happens to be one of the 44 items that the Smithsonian now has.
How did you acquire this? How did your dad acquire this?
Yeah. Each and every one has a special story. My dad started collecting back in the early 80s before the internet and before people had a penchant for sports items. It used to just be you went to see the game and after that you threw the tickets away and the pom-poms and everything. So he got lucky. You know, it's just lucky that it ended up being a wonderful asset. But my dad, when he started collecting, he made friends in the industry, like what happens in any industry, career, or hobby that you have. He would go to like really random baseball card shows in the bowels of some Ramada Inn in the back road of somewhere in Mississippi, and you meet someone who has an uncle who knows someone. You start off talking about baseball cards. Before you know it, you get a call because someone has Jesse Owens track shoes and they are willing to part with them. And are you a viable buyer? Mm-hmm. And so obviously my father's prominence as an attorney didn't hurt him being able to make these purchases. But more than that, my dad, in the world of collecting, in the world of historians, had really placed himself as a serious, serious archivist. And so he became good friends with other collectors and with family members of heroes who may not be with us anymore. And many times they would say, if I can't keep it, I want Jock to have it because I know he is not going to just sell it to the highest bidder or pilfer it. It will be held in high esteem. And if Jock ever lets it out of his vault, it will be somewhere meaningful, which is actually how we ended up getting the Marcus Garvey hat. And it came from somebody literally saying, my grandfather gave me this. I have no idea what to do with it. I heard about this attorney, and I'm going to give it to him. He gave it to my, this family gave it to my dad for nothing. He said, the only thing I need you to promise me is that you'll do something big with it.
And you're talking about the famous hat that is often seen in photographs of Marcus Garvey.
At least one of those.
It is
absolutely the one with the plumage. We don't have all the high plumage anymore. It was almost 100 years ago now, but it is my understanding from all the experts, it is the only known hat in its existence left from Marcus Garvey. Mm-hmm.
Mary, what is your favorite or may I dare say most poignant piece of the exhibit in the Slavery and Freedom exhibit for you?
I don't have a favorite object because I love all of them. Okay. And that's a true statement. But what I will say is I have two areas of the exhibition that I think are very moving. Three, actually. One is our section on the Middle Passage. We call that a sacred space. And we, a lot of people looked for, are you going to have moaning and a creaking ship and, you know, the sounds of the ocean? But we have it somewhat of a spare treatment, and you'll hear these voices that are actual, they're actors, but they're reading the quotes, first person quotes from people who were in the Middle Passage, who suffered through that experience, including those who observed what happened. So a ship surgeon and a crew member, you'll hear those first person quotes.
Excellent, excellent, yeah.
Then there's also these two walls. They're large walls, and one has hundreds of slave ship names on it. And with each slave ship name, it has the country of origin, the date of embarkation, and then it includes the number of enslaved people put on board and the number that ultimately came off the ship. So you start to realize the mortality of this experience, and you start to realize how in-depth this experience was commercially, but the human cost, right? And so it's powerful because you'll see names like Commerce or Africa Packet or The Happy Couple or Excellence for the names of these ships. That's just a fraction of ships, but the entire wall is covered by them. You turn the corner and we pulled out excerpts from bills of sale of enslaved men, women, and children. So you'll see descriptions like Old Ned, $11. Boy Jim, 35 years old. A 10-year-old girl sold for $1. Mm-hmm. And when you see these hundreds, again, hundreds of these entries, it's very, very powerful. So the design also helps us understand this history, and I'm very excited about that.
Interesting enough, when you talk about how, when you talk about the money for the purchase of slaves, when adjusted by modern dollars, slaves were extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm. Enslaved men, women, and children, by the time we got to the Civil War, the value in these human commodities, for lack of a better word, was more valuable than the value of land in this country.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Corey calling from Arnold. Corey, what's on your mind? Corey, give me a call back if you can. Emmanuel calling from Waldorf. What's on your mind?
202-319-7810.
Emmanuel, are you there? Turn your radio down, Emmanuel, please.
Hello?
Are you there?
Hello?
Go ahead. Turn your radio down. Okay, Emmanuel.
Yeah, I just want to let you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I went to the museum. The only thing that I thought didn't cover enough was the innovation part about African American. Can you just touch on that a little bit?
Immigration?
Innovation.
Oh, well, actually, there are many through lines that our director charged us with making sure that we cover throughout the exhibitions. So that includes gender. It includes faith. It includes innovation. And what you'll see is we don't have one specific exhibition on innovation, but you'll see it sprinkled throughout each of the exhibitions. And so it's really powerful. So, for example, you'll see in the Slavery and Freedom exhibition, we have the story of a man. We wanted to make sure that we didn't just paint this flat story of a human life. So we do it in three beats: life, work, and enslavement. So you'll see the story of a blacksmith named Solomon Williams, who was down in Louisiana, uneducated, but built this amazing drill bit, a double helix drill bit with no education. And it's a beautiful piece of art you know, in essence. He used those same skills to create the grave markers for his wife and other community residents in that enslaved community. And then he also, no doubt, used those same skills as the blacksmith on that plantation to create the restraints. So the double helix drill bit is work. The grave marker that we have featured that was done for his wife with this beautiful scrolling is life. And then the actual shackles that we show in this exhibition with his story is enslavement. So it gives you many different layers of one individual. But that's an example of some of the skills and innovative technological ability of African Americans.
Okay. Emmanuel, thank you so much. In the few minutes that I have left, Janae, what have you learned from the collection that your father started, and how has it changed you?
Wonderful question. Thank you. First of all, I'm an only child, so I didn't know how unique this collection was probably until I got to college. And, you know, you do that, your pilgrimage home for spring break with friends from other parts of the country, and they're like, what? He has what? 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 Is that Michael Jordan and Larry Bird? How does he have that? I'll be like, huh? What? I don't know. Let's go get some pizza. I didn't realize when I was younger what it was. Now that I'm older, and I also realized that my dad did this as a hobby, it was never for profit. It was always for passion. I now realize the foresight that he had and how intentional and deliberate he was on spending all his extra money on this collection, on making sure that he preserved it, making sure that he taught me enough about it so that I'm in the position to move the legacy forward. Because if I just had 10,000 pieces but didn't have a passion for it and didn't have any idea what these athletes meant, I don't know what I would have done with it. It might have ended up at Sotheby's and I would have bought a boat, you know?
Yeah, but there you go. Yeah.
But it did, that was not at all the case. So what I learned most importantly is know who you are, fight to tell the story, and no matter what someone tells you, pray on it, keep working, and you can achieve.
Mary, I've got about 30 seconds. What have you learned from your work here at the museum?
I've learned to be... to understand, to be a good steward, and to tell this story in a way that it impacts everybody. African American, white, you name it, everybody. This is a human story and an American story told through the African American lens.
I want to thank both of you for coming in and sharing your experiences with us. Also, we want to thank Mo Ivory and congratulate her on being a part of this museum. So Mary Elliott, Janae Smith, and of course Mo Ivory, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, September 21st. I'm Harold Fisher. You can reach me at hfisher@whur.com, on Facebook at Harold Fisher WHUR, or Twitter at Daily Drum WHUR. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.